From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's April the 8th, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo. He's at Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. Dan Zwicker is away this afternoon. In the second half hour of the program, on some of these stations and online at willag.org, Purdue Ag economist Chris Hurt will join us for a discussion of macroeconomics. We call that part of the program The Farming World. In agricultural news, a report is calling on FDA to revamp food inspection processes. Senator Harry Reid is urging three of his colleagues to complete a bill on climate change. And a federal judge has dismissed portions of an antitrust case against Dean Foods. We'll have details of these and other stories shortly. Also in this half hour, we'll hear a commentary from the Farm Bureau and from meteorologist Peter Levin. He'll help us take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast right here on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled up in Chicago on this Thursday afternoon, futures in the soft red winter wheat pit had a settlement price at $4.69 and a quarter for the May, down 6 cents. July at $4.82 and a half, 6 and a quarter lower. September futures at $4.99 and three quarters, down 5 and three quarters today. From Kansas City, nearby July at $4.96 and a quarter on its settlement price for the harvest month, 6 and three quarters lower. From the corn pit back in Chicago, $3.48 and a quarter, down 8 and a quarter for the May. July at $3.59 and a half, down 8 and one quarter, and September at $3.70. down 7 and three quarters. December corn, $3.81 and a quarter, down 7 cents. The March at $3.94 and a quarter, 6 and a half cents lower. May soybeans, $9.46 and a half, down 6. July at $9.56, 5 and a half lower. The August at $9.53, down 4 and three quarters. September soybeans, $9.42, down 3 and three quarters. And November contract, $9.37 and a half, down 3 and three quarters. May bean meal, $2.62.60, down $3. July at $2.62.30, down $2.30. Bean oil at $39.92, down 11 on the afternoon. July at $40.40, down 10 cents. April live cattle, $99.35, a dime lower. April feeder cattle at $112.87.5, down 17.5 cents. And the April lean hog futures in Chicago at the CME Group settled $76.67.5, down 50 cents. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from IPM. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. May crude oil futures, $85.63 a barrel, down 24 cents for the day. June at $86.25, down 26. May ethanol, $1.53 and 7 tenths, down a penny and 9 tenths. Natural gas at $3.91 and 9 tenths, a dime lower for the day. Heating oil or diesel fuel down 8 and 9 tenths at 2 and 223 and a half for the afternoon. And the gold futures now at $1,152.20, down 10 cents for the day, or rather, you know, down 10 cents an ounce. Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,947, just about 50 points higher. The dollar at 81.53, up 0.09, and the CRB index at 275.25, down 2.34 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like, as prepared by our own Mike Solem. He says rain totals exceeded 2 inches in south-central Indiana, and scattered 1-inch-plus amounts were noted in various Illinois and Indiana locations, but many places received less than half an inch. Rainfall will be limited in most sections of Illinois and Indiana for the next week to 10 days. A couple of disturbances are indicated to move across northern Illinois this weekend and early next week, but neither looks to produce any significant precipitation, he says. Excessive moisture will delay early field work in some low-lying areas, but generally conditions are favorable for early field work and planting, which should commence in some southern areas that certainly will be dry enough. Mike says topsoil moisture is adequate to abundant in all areas. Southeastern Indiana has a high potential for dryness concerns, but timely rainfall over the next 2 weeks would alleviate those issues. Some flooding and will continue in the river basins and drainage areas, but no widespread flooding should occur. More on the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with meteorologist Pete Levitt.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Thursday afternoon. Usually we talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's out of Decatur, Illinois. This afternoon, we're joined instead by Mike Zuzulo, as Dan is away from the office. Mike, of course, in Lafayette, Indiana, and he's at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Hey, how are you today?
Hey, we're doing great. A little bit colder than yesterday. I wasn't prepared for that.
Yeah, it's a little bit colder. We were out playing baseball last night, and it was fine for a while, and then it started to get colder, and we play again on Friday night, and I think that's going to be cold, too. But you know what? The warm weather looks like it's going to be around eventually here, and I think farmers will get started in the field, although there's some wet pockets that we're still dealing with. What do you hear regionally from your clientele?
Well, I think until last night's storms hit Ohio so hard, I would have said from central Ohio on I-70 all the way across to I-70, I-74 corridor all the way into central Illinois, stopping, you know, a little bit east of Springfield, that a lot of guys would be trying to go Sunday, Monday. That still seems to be the case if you take out of the picture Ohio, Todd. It sounds like that if the heat comes back and we get into the 70s like the forecasters are talking about this weekend, and there is indeed, you know, 5 or 6 days of wide open weather then in terms of rainfall potential, it sounds like a lot of guys are still going to go. A lot of rain happened west of Springfield, Jacksonville, Taylorville area. Those guys got anywhere from 1.8 to 3.8 inches from what I could tell today. So I think the trade probably picked up on that today in the corn market especially. It seemed like today was more of a supply-side day, kind of what we've been used to, whereas yesterday was more of a demand-side day.
Speaking of supply-side, we get some reports tomorrow morning. We'll get another look at what the ending stocks might show. There are some arguments that this one might change quite a bit, and either that could be either to the upside or to the downside. It might not change at all. What do you think will happen?
Exactly. I've got people in Chicago that are clamoring to take this carryover for 2009-2010 in corn well over 2 billion bushels, and I think the highest estimate of the Dow Jones estimates and Reuters estimates was 2.15 or something like that. So, yeah, and I think, again, that hit the trade today when we didn't get any confirmation of China's buying and demand coming from China like we did yesterday, and we saw the wide open weather, and we started to look at these pre-estimates. The average trade guess on corn is, you know, a little over 1.9 billion bushels. That'd be up about 123 million from USDA's March estimates. For beans, the trade estimate's a little over 200 million bushels. That would be up 18 million bushels, and that's just the domestic side. I think if you noted in the beans especially the weakness in the front end, I think that could be attributed to both our weaker basis interior and Gulf, but also I think the trade finally caught wind, the idea that maybe WASDE was going to bump up the Brazil production and the Argentine production and the Paraguay production. So I think at the end of the day or by mid-session, the trade was saying, okay, beans and wheat aren't holding the thing together. Let's go ahead and let them slide with corn because of these report numbers coming out.
All right. So, in fact, we do have two sets of report numbers, and we had to think of them as kind of separate reports because they come from two different agencies. The World Outlook Board will release the WASDE numbers, and then we'll have the NAS numbers as well. One will take a look at what the ending stocks will be in the United States. The other will take a look and adjust what production is around the world. We'll have to deal with both of those. If you'd like to get those numbers on your cell phone and you're signed up for our newsletter, that's possible. Or you can just go sign up for our newsletter at willag.org now. Hit to subscribe over on the right-hand side of the page. And when you fill out that information, give us your cell phone number, and you'll get those numbers texted to you. You'll also get them emailed to you as well in the morning. And the reports are due out at 7:30 a.m. Central Time. And, of course, they can always get them from you, too, can't they, Mike? How do they do that?
Yes, you bet.
How do they do that?
Well, all I got to do is go to the website, globalanalytics.biz, and sign up for a trial, and I start shooting them flash comments right away.
All right. Good way for people to get information early in the morning, just as soon as those reports come out. What do you think will happen tomorrow morning if the numbers don't change?
I think if you don't see a number change on the domestic side, Todd, I think that might actually be friendly because of what's going on in the outside markets and China's drought and China's currency issue. I think the biggest problem we face is what the South American production number may be, because I don't like the Gulf basis slipping. I don't like the interior basis slipping in beans. And I do think that the production numbers are there in the bean complex. So I've always been of the mindset that I'm not a big seller of corn if the beans hold together. So if the beans start to give way, that's when I start getting nervous about the whole complex. But I was doing almost everything I wrote today in terms of orders was buying bean puts, and I just left the corn and wheat alone.
Well, I was going to ask you about the wheat, but maybe we should leave it alone. Why did you leave it alone today?
Well, I think you've got the global demand coming back, and I think you've got the commodity trading funds covering shorts. And I think Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday have all been very, very good days for the wheat. And I think there's a bigger picture trend that may be shifting in the wheat where we've hit some price bottoms. Export sales this week were really good, reported this morning. And you had some temperatures that were pretty low this morning as well. So I think you factored in a lot of bearishness into the wheat already. And with that managed money starting to cover their short positions, they may continue to do that if there's nothing bearish on the report. And if the wheat finds a bottom here, I think it's going to be hard for the corn not to notice that as well. But again, I would say, and I'm stressing to clients, I'm not relying upon wheat with the corn as much as I am the beans at this stage because what time of the year we're in.
All right, turn your attention to a different marketplace. Crude oil, it's been in a seasonal trend upward. Can it continue that way?
I think it's going to be tough because we just got new numbers from the Department of Energy that go all the way back to January, and they showed a slip in unleaded gasoline demand. They showed a slip in the distillate demand. I think there's plenty of bullishness already factored into the crude oil, and with gasoline prices heading higher, not lower, I think we're going to continue to see demand struggle. So I'm a little bit of a contrarian here. I would not lock in any fuel needs at this point. I'd be buying hand-to-mouth and wait for something like a midsummer break before I'd go after anything more than a month, month and a half out.
As we close out our time together, any word on livestock?
Well, I do think that both April cattle and April hogs, as they get ready to expire, they may be putting in the high for the complex for the mid, you know, summer time period. So I think getting back on the idea of getting some summer hedges in place is probably a really good idea from a profitability standpoint and from a standpoint of the energy and how long the fund traders are right now.
Mike, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
Hey, you have a good day. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting, usually joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on Friday afternoon, filling in for Dan Zwicker, who's away from his office today. He's from ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. You can hear more from Mike tomorrow morning, if you'd like, on our website at willag.org. He'll be there after about 9:50 a.m. when we have him on our home radio station. But you can listen to him at that time when he talks with the director of ag programming here at WILL. That's Dave Dickey. Speaking of Dave, he'll be back in a moment with all the agricultural news for the day. Do visit willag.org for all the latest agricultural information.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In agricultural news, a report from the Health and Human Services Inspector General says there are significant weaknesses in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's program to inspect domestic food facilities. The report says the FDA needs to increase the number of domestic food inspections to keep up with foodborne outbreaks. The report says the FDA may need to request more authority from Congress so it has access to records from more food companies, and that food facilities with a history of serious violations have, at times, refused to give the agency access to their food records. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid reportedly is urging three senators to complete work on their proposed climate change bill alternative and to have detailed language available by mid-April. Senators John Kerry, Lindsey Graham, and Joe Lieberman say they plan to release details of their plan within the next few weeks. The three senators have indicated they want to complete language over the spring recess, with some sources indicating the climate change bill could be ready on Earth Day, April 22nd. Congress returns from its recess next Monday. A federal judge on Wednesday refused to dismiss portions of the U.S. Justice Department's antitrust complaint against Dean Foods, but he also found shortcomings in the government's lawsuit. The Justice Department sued Dean Foods in January, seeking to undo its $35 million acquisition of two Wisconsin dairy processing plants from Foremost Farms USA, a dairy cooperative. The department argued that the deal eliminated substantial competition in milk sales to schools, grocery stores, and convenience stores in Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. The judge, in a written order, says that the government's allegations were sufficient for the case to proceed, but he also criticized the Justice Department's legal complaint, saying it lacked specificity and was not well structured. The chief executive of the Sugar Association says sugar is being unfairly blamed for obesity problems in the U.S. at a time when per capita consumption of sweeteners has declined over the past decade. Andrew Briscoe says that linking sugar to obesity is misleading because most of the sweeteners used in the beverage industry are from high fructose corn syrup. Briscoe says that according to data from the U.S. Agriculture Department and the Centers for Disease Control, U.S. per capita sugar consumption has fallen 40% since 1970. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of this program, Commodity Week and The Farming World. That program follows the closing market report right here on some of these radio stations and online at willag.org. That's willag.org. Up next, in today's Listener Opinion Forum, Shelby County Farm Bureau's Amy Rochkus says agricultural trade is a vital piece of the farm economy.
Are essential to the prosperity of the United States agriculture. Trade is the backbone of agriculture, with about 25% of the total volume of farm production exported. Additional U.S. commodities have an even higher dependence on world trade. U.S. agricultural trade has been tossed to the curb with the stalled World Trade Organization talks. Instead of picking up the slack and passing bilateral trade agreements, Congress has been sitting on its hands and ignoring already negotiated trade deals while other countries take advantage of our idleness. Consequently, what should have been significant trade opportunities for the United States has turned into trade warfare in Washington, D.C. This year, more than 600 bilateral and regional trade agreements will be negotiated around the world. While President Barack Obama called for doubling U.S. exports over the next 5 years in his State of the Union address, getting Congress to act is another matter. While the United States is not opening markets through new trade agreements, many other countries are negotiating bilateral and regional agreements that are reducing the United States agriculture industry's competitiveness and market share around the world. Agricultural trade is not only critical to the industry, but an aggressive trade agenda is important for the U.S. economy and the creation of American jobs. It is estimated that a drop in agricultural exports from 2008 to 2009 cost roughly 160,000 American jobs. The positive impact of exports, such as job creation, will continue to be diminished as long as the United States is not moving forward with an agricultural trade agenda. It is critical that Congress passes pending trade deals and works with the administration to seek new export opportunities. This is Amy Rochkis with the Shelby County Farm Bureau.
Amy Rochkis' comments are her own and reflect her opinions. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station. We strongly urge listeners like you to become involved by sharing your views as well. To do so, just give us a call. The number is 217-333-0850. Last week, USDA released the first official estimate of how many corn and soybean acres U.S. farmers are expected to plant this season. It showed more of both, but as you'll hear, it takes a much broader perspective to put those numbers into context. That broader perspective of the USDA's acreage report means looking deeper into the numbers and at other crops, says University of Illinois ag economist Darrell Good.
We saw all winter wheat acres and intentions for spring wheat down 5.3 million acres, intentions for oil seeds up 1.4, feed grains up 1.7, cotton up 1.4, a modest increase in rice, hay, and dry beans, and so that accounted for all of the decline in wheat acres. So unlike some of the prospective plantings reports we've received in the past, this one seems to account for all of the acres that are out there. I don't think we have to wonder about will there be more acres showing up later on and which crops will they go to. I think this one pretty much accounts for all of the cropland acres.
The USDA NAS Prospective Plantings Report projects farmers in the United States will sow 88.8 million acres of corn this season and 78.1 million acres of soybeans. Both figures are larger than the 2009 planted acreage area. It's pretty easy to figure where most of those extra corn and soybean acres came from, says Darrell Good, the lack of winter wheat seedings last fall. And unlike previous reports, the ag economist from the University of Illinois says this one seems to take account for all the acreage.
It makes some difference whether you look at soybeans and corn or whether you broaden the picture and look at oil seeds and feed grains, because we're not only seeing a 650,000-acre increase in intended soybean acres, but another 750,000 acres of other oil seeds, that's where we get the 1.4 million acres increase in oil seeds. So I think that paints a little more negative picture than just the soybean number alone. And in corn and feed grains, you see just the opposite picture, 2.3 million acres more corn, 600,000 less other feed grains for a net of only 1.7 million acres of feed grain. So you would have to argue that that, on the surface, might be just a little bit more supportive than what the market is interpreting the report.
Darrell Good is an ag economist at the U of I. He writes a weekly commodities outlook letter updated on Mondays. It can be found on the FarmDoc website. The address is www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. In about 2 minutes, I'll talk with agricultural meteorologist Peter Levitt about the weather. And then after that, on many of these radio stations during the farming world, we'll talk with Purdue Extension ag economist Chris Hurt about the economics of the farm and the world.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
In business news, U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and China's Vice Premier exchanged views on U.S.-China economic relations and the global economy during a meeting in Beijing today. The Treasury Department made a brief statement which made no reference to U.S. concerns over China's currency practices. Today's meeting came amid speculation that Beijing might soon unveil a long-awaited shift in strategy by revaluing its currency, the yuan. Target says sales at stores open at least a year rose 10.3% in March on growth in apparel sales. The retailer now says its first quarter results will beat estimates due to the March performance, which exceeded the company's expectations. The company's total sales rose 12.5% in the period to $6.23 billion. Official figures show that retail sales in the 16 countries that use the euro fell once again in February as consumers remain reluctant to spend despite the end of the recession and low borrowing costs. Retail sales in the eurozone dropped by 0.6% in February. The decline is unexpected. Most analysts were anticipating at least a flat outcome during the month. And the Bank of England today kept interest rates at a record low of 0.5% for the 13th month running and made no increase to its £200 billion asset buying plan to boost the economy. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Uvalde Extension's Todd Gleason. On the phone line with us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast is meteorologist Pete Labatt. Good afternoon to you, Pete.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Producers will be anxious to get into the field after a little rainfall here in the Midwest. Will that happen soon?
Yes, I think so. We're not looking at much in the way of precipitation for the next week or so. We had this system go through this morning, and as a matter of fact, the center of low pressure passed over northeastern Illinois early this afternoon, and we even saw some snow in northwest Illinois with this cold air coming in behind the weather system. But this system is rapidly moving out of the way, northeastward up into across the Great Lakes and into Canada. And the high pressure is going to build through the area over the next several days. And the only questionable weather, I think, is on Sunday. Another system from the northwest may push a cold front just far enough south into northern Illinois to produce a few light showers. But we're not looking for any general rain at all. And most of the state, especially downstate Illinois, should have mostly fair weather through the balance of the week. And temperatures after a cold night tonight. By the way, we looked for some frost tonight, pretty much north of I-70 in the western two-thirds of the state. We should get temperatures down below freezing briefly, but there's nothing far enough along for that to be damaging. And then temperatures will bounce right back up into the 70s on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, 70s all next week, maybe even touching 80 by late in the week, and no significant precipitation. So that's the dry weather that we're looking for.
Oh, that should be good. We'll start to dry out the topsoil, maybe even get into some of the subsoil moisture because of those higher temperatures. Do we get a bit of wind along with it to speed the dry out?
Early on, it'll come in with some wind, then it'll be only light and variable winds for a few days, the middle of next week, and then the winds will pick up from the southwest later in the period. So, yeah, we'll get a little help from the drying on this.
It seems to me that out west that we've got a fairly quick start to the release of dormancy of the hard red winter wheat. Is that going to be a problem with cold weather at all or not?
Well, it would have been last night, incidentally, was an unusually cold night in the Texas Panhandle, Texas and Oklahoma Panhandles, and though some of the major stations showed readings only down into the mid-20s, which is pretty cold in, on its own, a lot of the rural stations were in the upper teens in the northern two-thirds of the Texas Panhandle up through the Oklahoma Panhandle and into southeastern Colorado. Now, the crop isn't far enough along in Colorado for that to be serious, but it could have been far enough along in parts of the panhandle of Texas to cause some damage. We haven't heard much about it, and we probably won't know if anything did happen for a few days anyway. But that cold air was localized pretty much to the western third of the hard winter wheat belt. Otherwise, we need the drier weather here in central Illinois and on eastward. where the winter wheat crop so far has shown a fairly high percentage in poor or even very poor condition. That may be rectified if we can get some warm temperatures as we're looking for in some drying weather.
Pete, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Hey, we'll talk to you again next week. Pete Levitt, agricultural meteorologist. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report each and every Thursday afternoon. We'll say so long to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, stay with us. We'll talk with Chris Hurt during The Farming World.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with Purdue University Extension ag economist Chris Hurt. He joins us from the Lafayette campus. Good afternoon to you, Chris. Thanks for being with us today.
Todd, always a pleasure.
Let's start with just a wide open view of the economy and how agriculture works into it in your viewpoint at this point in time.
Well, I think I've probably been a little more optimistic overall on the general economy than what we've seen in a lot of the headlines over the last 6 months. My sense is that the recovery, that we are in recovery, we've been in recovery for three quarters now, that the recovery is going to be slow. There's no question there are some other concerns. There are still many concerns to work through in this economy. None the least of which is unemployment is certainly going to stay high. The growth in our economy is not going to be fast enough to really bring that down quickly. But I think the other side of that is to say that a lot of businesses have gotten through this. They have gotten very lean in terms of their cost of production. They've learned to at least break even, maybe operating at 60-70% of capacity. And when you start to turn back to the upside, put more production in place, get more business, those costs are down there so low that actually we can see some profitability. I think we are going to see interest rates start up reasonably quickly. That'll be the short-term interest rates. My general view on inflation is that it's going to be quite moderate for several years, and I think that's certainly the direction we have been on. The concern really gets to be about 3 to 5 years out, as we really begin to deal with the budget deficits and the aftermath that they are creating with interest rates that are now on up in at least the 4-5% range on 2-3 year money. The cost is very, very high from an interest standpoint, and that's where we can get into the scenario of adding more interest, essentially increasing our money supply rate of growth more rapidly to help handle some of that debt. And that devalues our currency and leads to more inflation. My view of inflation is that it will be more in accommodating 3-4% range as we get out to 2014, maybe 2015. But there's certainly those in agriculture that want to build a hyperinflation, double-digit inflation, and say that commodities and land values will really go up sharply. I think we will see more inflation, but I'd sure keep it away from that hyperinflation we saw in the late 70s and very early 1980s.
Land values have remained strong in the Midwest through this period of economic turmoil and have doubled in the last several years. With inflation in the picture, whether it's the type of inflation you're talking about, a low growth rate, or hyperinflation, is land still a good source of revenue for investors? And does it make sense, do you think, for farmers to purchase property?
Well, I think right now, when you look at, say, average land values, and we're not talking about the highest land value sale at any coffee shop in the state of Illinois or Indiana, but if you look at the averages, investors are able to get something in the range of, say, 2.5-3% return. And what we're talking about there, if you're an outside investor, investing that farmland, taking the cash rent, take some taxes, real estate taxes off of that, a little bit of management fee, it's going to net a return of something in the 2.5 to 3% range. That's really not an unreasonable rate of return given the alternatives right now. Giving money, say, in 2, 3, 4 year CD rates or even a little bit longer than that. If one is in the stock market, you can look at dividend yield, the amount of dividends that stocks are paying, and generally those are going to be pretty low, down in the perhaps 2% range. And so what land does, a lot like stock, say a dividend-paying stock might pay 2% dividends, but you have the chance of capital appreciation. And I think that's exactly where we're at on farmland. It's not horribly overpriced for the returns an investor could get right now. Now, on the other hand, I think another component of value of land to a farmer is how much return can I get from that right at this point. And what we saw as we look over the past 5-7 years is there were really only two good years, good returns from cropping. Those were the 07 crop and the 08 crop. There we had really good returns as commodity prices, and let's talk about grain prices, went up sharply and really rose more rapidly than they drew up the cost. By the time we got to the 09 crop and now what it looks like for the 10 crop, we're back to very tight margins. So I think that does at least give me a reason to pause and say, is the next 5, 10, 15% going to come in land values now when we're basically back to much better balances of supply and demand in the world in terms of grains? We have kind of begun to finally catch up with the biofuels demand surge for corn as well as soybean oil, and really beginning to get back into that better equilibrium of supply and demand. Are we going to have the return structure that convinces farmers they should keep their hands up? So I think you almost have to say that my attitude would be land values are kind of at a plateau right now. I don't think they're terribly overpriced, but I would say they're kind of at a plateau. Those who are willing to put their hands up are more believers that inflation is going to come back into our economy and drive those land values higher. Those that are kind of cautious are looking a little heavier at the returns right now and saying those returns just are not that strong.
Yeah, well, historically, they're not as strong as what land has returned over the long run, something a bit greater than the 1.5 to 2 or even close to 3%, I suppose, you might be able to get from a piece of farmland at this point.
Sure, that's right. And again, always we have to look at what time period are we talking about. But I'm going to go back to, say, the 20-year time horizon, which certainly isn't the long run for many of the grandfathers out there that go back 50, 60 years in terms of their horizon on land. But we see the land returns over that 20-year horizon, if you look at both the yearly return to the land from, say, cash renting that, and then the appreciation, has been up in the 10-11% range. So it's been very good. The decade of the 1990s, we saw the stock market actually be a better set of returns than land. But boy, the dot-com bubble early this decade, and finishing the stock market off then at the end of the decade with the recession and the financial crisis makes farmland look like tremendous returns compared to the stock market. Huge volatility in that stock market. Farmland, the 20-year horizon, is very, very positive.
And then if you go further back?
Well, obviously that those numbers, we go back to 1986, 1987, the bottoming of the farmland values, but the previous 20 years to that, the 1970s and 1980s, was the boom and the bust. So the boom in the 1970s, and then the decline or massive adjustment to the downside in land values then from about 1981 to 1987. In that adjustment to the downside, we saw probably a 55 to 60% drop in average farmland values in the states of Illinois and Indiana. So it really depends on that time period that you're looking at. My sense is that you have to build a pretty hefty inflation scenario into these land values for them to really have much upside potential over the next 5 years.
What do you think a good size for a farm in Indiana might be for a single family and with one operator? And in that, how would you put the mix of owned property, cash rented property, and that would be share rent?
Sure, and again, those are great questions. I think we start off on size by saying the capital investment, particularly from just a how many acres standpoint, revolves around the combine. Again, the single biggest cost item. So we kind of come in units of combines. So the size that accommodates one combine and kind of maximizes acreage across that one combine would be a unit. Then you'd like to expand, and that may be something in the 2,000, 2,500 acre range. Then you'd like to expand in terms of that unit, add another 2,000 or 2,500. Now, we all know that's not generally the way it works in agriculture. You can't just go out and say, okay, I'm going to add another 2,500 acres this year. So I would tend to say that is a size for commercial operations that makes a lot of sense. The question of the mix of owned versus the leased or rented acres has a lot to do with probably somewhat age aggressiveness of individuals, but clearly return on personal capital, return on equity, certainly can grow much faster over time by really using the leverage of controlling the land through rent and then farming more and more acres rather than the ownership. In terms of wealth development over time, now we're back to what really is going to happen to land values, and clearly over time, wealth development has been very good through the ownership side. That mix, I haven't done specific research on that, so I don't want to overextend the educational knowledge base, but I think many producers would like to have a third of their land owned and then two-thirds rented. Obviously, that doesn't work out in many cases, just simply because lack of availability of capital or lack of availability of land to either buy or rent.
If the combine is the defining point for size on acreage, and you say 2,000 to 2,500 or 2,500 is about what we should be running through, I'm assuming an eight-row combine at this point. What's the average size of the farm in the state of Indiana?
Well, the average size is around 280 acres, if you look at the statistical definition of a farm. So much different than that.
And the average size of a grain farm, how about that?
Yeah, and again, what we're dealing with there is the definition of a farm is any operation that has the potential to sell $1,000 of agricultural goods in a year. So this would make most of your absentee landowners that maybe had mom and dad had 100 acres and it got split between four kids. They're selling $1,000. They end up as being defined as farmers. So some very small operations get in that data. I would tend to think that if we try to define farm, this category you're looking at is commercial farms, where the primary source of income for that family is coming from the farm. Obviously, many, many small part-time farmers, their primary source of income is from off-farm sources. So I think, you know, we probably, of the people I talk to in the Extension Service as we go out and do farmer meetings, my guess is for commercial farmers, that number would probably be much smaller than that, 700-800 acres up to 1,000 acres on average.
We're talking this afternoon with Purdue University Extension Ag Economist Chris Hurt. This is The Farming World. It's from the University of Illinois, the land grant here in Urbana-Champaign, and a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. We'll continue our conversation with Chris Hurt when we return.
It's National Empanada Day. Empanadas are made by folding a thick circular-shaped dough patty over a stuffing, creating its typical semicircular shape. Pastry is the traditional Latin version of the U.S. Hot Pocket. On this day in agricultural history in 1862, John D. Lindy of Philadelphia patented the first aerosol dispenser. In 1873, Alfred Paruff received a patent for the first commercially viable margarine manufacturing process, but he was a little too successful. When margarine sales threatened butter sales, state and federal officials levied taxes on margarine. In 1879, the Echo Farms Dairy of New York began selling milk in glass bottles, the first time that ever happened in the U.S. In 1898, the first U.S. College of Forestry was created at Cornell University. In 1911, Melvin Calvin was born. Calvin was an American biochemist who discovered how carbon dioxide is absorbed into green plants and its conversion into carbohydrates and other organic compounds. And in 1992, Benjamin Eisenstadt died. He invented the artificial sweetener Sweet'n'Low. When saccharin became popular in the 1950s, it was originally only available as a liquid or as tiny pills. Eisenstadt mixed saccharin with dextrose to create saccharin in a packet form. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Sarah Lukacs in Morris at 815-941-3709. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Purdue University Extension ag economist Chris Hurt. When we last talked with him, we were discussing the size of a combine and that it was the defining factor for the size of acreage that a producer might want to have. A regular size combine or a combine that a producer might operate would generally, according to Dr. Hurt, run about 2,500 acres, and that's probably according to John Deere and Case as well. On the other hand, the average size of a commercial farm, you tell me, in the state of Indiana is probably 700 to 800 acres. Is there anything that a producer in your state ought to be doing in order to work with the difference in scale between those two, the size of the combine and the size of the acreage they're actually operating?
Well, again, I think what we recognize is that many of our farm families have other opportunities such as livestock. And again, that's a very traditional complementary enterprise with the cropping production. So perhaps that's where they can really expand due to limitations on acquiring more land or cash renting more land, that they can expand into that direction. Clearly, off-farm income becomes another important category for some of those farms. And so I think we would continue to say that they probably can gain some lowering of their cost per acre through utilizing that machinery to the maximum number of acres that they can get through it and do that in a timely manner. On the other hand, that just is not the way that land comes to some families in their neighborhoods, and it just is not in the possibility set for them to expand in that manner to really gain the full economies. So this may be a situation where while they are not able to gain the full economies, they may be able to utilize their machinery over a longer period of time, not trade as often. They may be able to use some of their personal or family mechanical skills to keep that machinery running over more years. And typically some of those families, when times are tight financially, will say, I can farm as long as my combine keeps going. When I have to trade combines, that's the point at which I'm going to have to make a decision, can I continue or can I not continue? So I think while there's sort of this optimum, it seems, in terms of lowering cost per unit with the machinery set, in reality, there are some other ways to supplement that family income. And so we do see perhaps what you might consider non-optimum farm sizes, but they may be very optimum for the mix of resources, the land that can be acquired for that particular family. Yeah. I think what this also says that over time, we still have reason to believe there will be some movement to larger commercial farms on average over time.
It seems certainly to be a sad commentary that the size of combines that are available sets the size of a good farm. I guess it goes to what agriculture has done over the decades in becoming far more efficient as a production facility.
I think, again, it gets back to the question of is the farm as a business, and as a business, over time, we will see the farm unit size move towards the optimum in terms of total profitability per acre, but that has a lot to do with, of course, keeping the cost per acre or per bushel to a minimum. So, again, I think we'll see that in terms of the economics, the business. That's what drives, unless we constrain it in some way, say by law, pass laws that say people can't be above a certain size. And the other question you bring up is a way of life. Is the farm a way of life? Great for kids, great for teaching many important principles of character, having hands-on opportunities for young people. I think, our farm operations are almost unparalleled for families in doing that relative to, say, urban families. But as a business, that's what will really drive the model over time. Even though we do have substantial government policy that tries to redistribute, if you will, some income to give priorities to more family-scale operations rather than larger commercial operations in terms of government support. So economics is very powerful.
Dr. Hurt, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Chris Hurt, Extension Ag Economist from Purdue University, joining us from the Lafayette, Indiana campus. You've been listening to the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant here in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a great afternoon. Next time on the Farming World, we'll explore the University of Illinois VetMed Open House. It's scheduled for this weekend. And we'll talk with Joe Prasaki of USDA NAS. That's the National Agricultural Statistics Service. You can hear it on this radio station and online anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org.